Hello and welcome back, everybody, to the Ortho Talk podcast, episode number 22. This week, we are joined by a very special guest, Dr. Ronald Navarro. You may know Dr. Navarro if you are anywhere in the Southern California area, because he is the regional chief of orthopedic surgery at Kaiser Permanente, which basically means that he oversees more than 200 different orthopedic surgeons across 13 different Kaiser Permanente centers across California. Dr. Navarro specializes in sports medicine, and he did his fellowship at Pittsburgh after doing his residency at UCLA. And we talk about how being a hospital employed physician is good and bad and what that means in 2020. We really break down the business side of it and reimbursement models and all sorts of stuff that we haven't really touched on yet on this podcast. So give it a listen. Hope you guys enjoy it. And without further ado, Dr. Ron Navarro.
Hey, can we time out? All right, all good dudes, stop what you're doing. This is Time Out. This is the Ortho Talk podcast. Today we are doing a real conversation with an illustrious guest. Surgeons today are Asif Khalid and Jay Chen. Antibiotics, ANSEF, of course, what do we even ask? Fire risk, high due to lit conversations and explosive topics. Any questions or concerns? Nope. All right, we can go. Incision.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Ortho Talk podcast, episode number 22. This week, we have a very, very special guest with us, Dr. Ronald Navarro. Dr. Navarro is joining us from sunny Southern California, as you can see from his beautiful trees and light in the background. I heard the weather there is over 100 degrees right now. At least that's
what it's looks. Been. Really, yeah, it's been really hot for the last couple of days. I know it's cutting into my jogging outside time.
yeah, it's a special place over there. But yeah, thanks for joining us. You are at Kaiser Permanente, correct?
Yes, sir.
Perfect. And so why don't you tell us, let's just start with a little bit about your background and what you do and, you know, what your situation is like.
Sure. You know, born and raised in Southern California, you know, I know you all do a lot of work in educating medical students, residents and the like, as well as attendings with the great podcast work you're doing. And so just for those out there looking at the diversity theme, you know, I came from a background where my father was an immigrant from Mexico and no formal education. So just a plug for that. It's still doable, you know, in this world.
Yeah.
And the American dream of having kids grow up and become educated and fundamentally change their trajectory is California, one of five boys, and did all the schooling two of you have done, college at the University of California, Santa Barbara Med School, University of Illinois, orthopedics in Southern California at Harbor UCLA, at the county program associated with UCLA, and then a fellowship at University of Pittsburgh, J.P. Warner, Freddie Fu, and Chris Harner, and, you know, Chris is down in Texas now, and JP's in Boston, but really great mentors. And I've been I did 1 year of private practice, and then I've been at KP for 23 years and have assumed a lot of different leadership roles and really proud of what we're making there.
So just 1 year of private practice?
Yeah, it was, I mean, it's a funny story in and of itself. I mean, for those who are early on in practice, it's okay to change. And I was in a situation where there was a lot of expectation of me, and I'm never afraid of hard work, but I didn't know if the billings were being done correct. And then this other opportunity came about. And I was just real happy to be able to do that with the group that I'm with now, because it was closer to where I grew up and closer to the ocean.
Yeah.
So it's for a variety of reasons. The folks I was with were great, and I was able to kind of just move on to a better situation for me personally.
First heard you talk about 3 years ago at the AOA Resident Leadership Conference, and they had three speakers. Each was talking about a certain type of job, either private practice, academic, or employed. And you gave the talk on being employed. So can you speak a little bit about the benefits of being hospital employed and why that fits you and what you like about it?
Oh, no, thanks for the question. those are some great educational experiences for both me and the residents and fellows, I think, who can get to take part in that AOA program. So thanks for bringing it up. It's always a good time. And yeah, that was with Bill Levine and Javier Giralde. And so for me in, you know, the employed medicine world, I really enjoy the fact that some of the issues of billing and that sort of thing are taken away, and I could just focus on the practice of medicine a little bit more. Certainly, we're all fiduciaries in our relationship with I'm a Permanente physician, and Kaiser's the health plan and insurance company, and we're all fiduciaries in ensuring that patients get best care and that the care shows value, the idea of good outcomes and relatively low cost, because then you can give more people the care. But it cuts out some of the issues of expectation on my part to bill a certain amount. And we have just enjoyed a great position in Kaiser Permanente, being in Southern California, to be able to hire best and brightest. And so they come in motivated and do what they want to do, but do it very well. And we don't have issues of volumes, et cetera. So for me, it cuts. I probably do not enjoy the biggest top side of reimbursement for my yearly income, but I have an incredible amount of stability and built in, especially in my situation in Southern California with the Southern California Permanente Medical Group, the Permanente Group that is associated with Kaiser in Southern California. There's great retirement benefits. So we don't get to do gain sharing. We don't get to have MRIs that we own or surgery centers that we own. But when we retire with a retention of a great amount of our income and a retirement program that pays us to keep a similar amount of income. So it's a bit of a trade-off. And, you know, I'll also say, for those who might say, well, you don't have as much autonomy. It's true. I tell folks all the time who work with me and for me in our program that it's not called Ron Navarro Medical Center. It's called Kaiser Permanente. And so you give up a little bit of autonomy, and I'm the boss, but you learn to work in teams. And in these complex environments, this teaming approach is probably better. And for the autonomy I give up, I have a security. So I don't know if that answers the question for you.
So let me ask you, what, as far as giving up autonomy, is there anything specifically that really bugs you the most that you wish you could just control?
Yeah, you know, others probably could level this at me. And so you're asking me about a potential criticism of our situation. You know, when you work with people and you rely upon them in a person in the clinic area who you expect to do a certain thing, or a person in the OR who you expect to have a certain level of expertise, or a person on the floor, mm-hmm. sometimes that doesn't always match up. And I only can assume that in a private situation, I would have so much relative import because of the cases I bring to the hospital. I say, that person keeps failing. Please, I don't want to work with them. In my situation, I don't have that ability to kind of do that. I have to try and help to process, improve the person's behavior. Right. And so maybe I'm making assumptions about the power that others have. I just don't have that power. I have to kind of get along with people and figure out how to improve them and the lot of everybody, rather than just say, sure. You know, I bring a lot of cases to this hospital, and I don't ever want to see that person in my room again. So I don't know if that, you know.
No, the answer is
not the way that anybody can behave anymore, you know, given the state of affairs and in how we have to treat each other with a certain amount of, you know, respect and kindness. But I would only assume that other people in other situations have a relative power that I don't, and I don't want it. I don't seek it. But that you asked what frustrates me, and it frustrates me when people are not living up to their abilities, you know, and it's slowing down cases, and systems optimization is not realized because of that.
Right. Do you go ahead, Jay.
In the Kaiser model, are there bonuses for productivity? Are there incentives? How does it work for those who are not familiar with that?
So we don't have gain sharing or bonuses for the most part. We do focus on things like access to patient care, and the state of California regulates us really heavily. So in that, we need to ensure that patients who are new, who are first-time consults or new visits, get in to see us at a very high rate, like 80 to 90% within 2 weeks of the consult being created, or else the state can fine us. So at the end of the year, we get bonuses based on things like that. There are some other bonuses that we get based on other achievable goals that kind of focus on patient care, operating room utilization, and things like that. And it's not a ton of extra money, but I think it all goes in the focus of patient care. And I can just tell you, you know, without stating my personal income, our incomes are sitting as well as guys in private. I live in a community that's very nice, and the guy across the street from me trained with me, and he's a private practice orthopedic spine surgeon. They do pretty well. Mm-hmm. So we live in the same community. So, I mean, just without having to give away the farm on the income and have my wife be mad. I'm doing okay, and I'm, living a wonderful life and being able to enjoy a time off. That's the other thing in this employed situation for me, you know, there's increasing amounts of time off every year. So there's now I'm up to 6 or 7 weeks of paid vacation. So when I go on vacation, I'm not losing any money. I'm just losing overtime money. So we get paid more money and extra money on nights and weekends, mm-hmm. beyond our supposed 40 hours of pay. So those are all benefits. It works for me. It probably doesn't work for everybody. I've had friends who were in private and wish they were in, and friends who are in private and never want to be in. So it works for the right type of person. But to live in Southern California, and we also have access to research and things like that. So to be able to live in Southern California, live a sort of an academic life, but be in a big group practice and have all the benefits of the economies and scale of a large EMR and things like that. Those are kind of the things that I think people really appreciate.
So do you have medical students and residents also?
We've always had medical students from UCLA and USC, which are close, mm-hmm. and Kaiser Permanente just started a medical school this year. So we'll begin to have medical students rotate through. And so because the medical school, it represents all of Kaiser Permanente, which is in 7 or 8 states, but the school is housed in Southern California. So we're going to start having medical students. They literally just started in July. And they're doing, the initial mm-hmm. rotations that you all remember from medical school. So they're not ready for an orthopedic subspecialty, but we're starting to discuss ortho and musculoskeletal medicine rotations as well. So we're going to have more of those too. And some of our, I'm the regional orthopedic chief for all of Southern California, and there's 13 medical centers. Mm-hmm. And so I help to with each of the medical center chiefs over 50,000 square miles to kind of run the orthopedic programs. Certainly, they do a lion's share of the work at their places, but in that, the medical students can go to each of those locations, and so we get people from all over.
Yeah,
and some of those places have like sports medicine, orthopedic fellowships, and things like that.
Gotcha.
And so we get fellows too that rotate through.
Dr. Navarro, being the chief of the whole region—that's impressive. Like, I'm trying to juggle my small clinic here, and you're running the whole region. What all goes into that, and how much time do you spend doing that versus clinical duties?
Yeah. No, great question. I just started that in 2013. I took varied leadership roles at KP. I started in 97. When I became a partner in 2000, I became the chair of that department, that one of the 13 medical centers, or the chief of that department. And it was small then, 5 or 6 orthopedists. Now we're like 10 or 12 orthopedists and more PAs. And there's also podiatrists who work with us too. And so after, from 2000 to 2009, I did that job. I did a different job running all the, managing all the surgeons at that medical center, including orthopedists, general surgeons, plastic plastics, head and neck, et cetera, at that medical center until 2013 when he took the regional job over 13 medical centers, but just orthopedic surgeons. So you learn to be efficient with your time. A certain amount of ADD helps you to kind of manage this stuff. And you become adept at managing a lot of issues via short responses on your phone with all the emails that are sure to come. Yeah. But to answer your other question, it's about 50% of the time. But I wear a lot of administrative hats. I also have a business management role and help to oversee. We've started to open target clinics, and that's for primary care, but I help to oversee that work, and there's some other business management roles I have too. So I'm about 50% administrative, 50% orthopedic, clinical now. And I also help to oversee the registries. So I'm doing a lot of registry research. But, you know, like you guys have probably done research. That's in the cracks of time, you know, mm-hmm. nights, weekends, when your family is asleep on a Saturday night at 3 a.m. Yeah. So they're not seeing you. You know, you're cheating on them by doing research.
Exactly.
So, yeah, I mean, just juggle a lot, but I really enjoy it. And you know, I'm very fortunate. The 13 medical center chiefs are all real solid and really motivated. And we just kind of set goals, make sure that the direction is the right for those goals, and keep achieving goals each year.
Did you undergo any formal business training, like an MBA or business classes to prepare you for these leadership?
That's really great. Yeah, great question. Kaiser Permanente puts us through a lot of stuff. They have like a middle management course where you nice. Do like a 1 week in residence and learn middle management. At a different time, they have an advanced management course where you go for another week away at a hotel and learn from people, both internal speakers, and they bring in external speakers. And then there's interspersed courses, like things like having a difficult conversation course and things like that for mid-level managers or people like a chief of a department, you know,
right.
It's a lot of adult babysitting, you know. Everybody's doing their surgeries right, but somebody's, you know, yelling at a nurse or yelling at another partner. You know, it's all that kind of bogs you down. So you always have to have tough conversations with people. But then when I got higher and did more work, I was fortunate because they don't avail this opportunity to everybody. I was able to go to Harvard Business School through Kaiser Permanente and spend, it's not an MBA, but it's 4 weeks, two separate 2 week periods of living in the dorms in Cambridge. And oh, wow. You get like an executive leadership piece of paper. You know, it's not an MBA. I'm very clear on that, but to, you know, in your 40s. And at that point I was in my late 40s to go back to college and live in a dorm. I was like a kid in a candy store. It's great. It's great learning, and really brilliant professors, you know, at Harvard Business School. And the 4 weeks of that is really kind of washed over me and helps to kind of make me think differently. But you know, you guys are doing it right now. It's always continuous education. You're always learning from others. JP Warner, who I had said earlier, was one of my mentors. He really believes in value, and he's really pushed that forward. And so he and I talk a lot. We just recently wrote a paper together, even all these years later. Mm-hmm. And so you're constantly learning new concepts. Friend Kevin Bozick, who's at
Austin,
Dental
right?
Medical Schools, yep. Has really pushed forth the ideas of value. And he has colleagues that talk about condition-based care and how to look at, you know, instead of bundles, are we going to someday, will your medical group take care of knee pain? And some payer will pay you millions of dollars for all the knee pain in the encatched population you have. And they just pay you the money, and whether you do scopes on them, total knees on them, or give them all PRP, you just get one set of money, and you figure out how to manage that condition from start to finish. And maybe you pull in primary care sports people, PAs, you know, whatever, pain management people, and your team manages it. So some of that I've learned since all this formal training. But I mean, I guess short, quick answer, yes, I got a lot of extra training.
So, it sounds like EP is they're very invested in you guys and training you guys, and that's great. That's a really good transition too to this concept of value-based healthcare, which is something I remember. I was getting I have a master's of public health degree from when I was in medical school, and I remember first hearing about it then and being exposed to this concept. And quite honestly, since that year, probably about 7 or 8 years ago, I haven't thought about it very much, because then you go on to residency and you focus on learning orthopedics and you focus on the system that you practice in. But then this year at the AOA annual meeting, that was the theme of the meeting. And I feel like it's coming back in my life in a big way, and just in terms of how much I'm hearing about it. So why don't we, you know, for people, we have medical students on this who listen to our podcast and residents, and you know, just very broadly, what is value-based healthcare? How is that different than the traditional ways we've thought about healthcare?
Well, you know, Michael Porter, who is a big professor at Harvard Business School and has really written a lot on this subject and talks about, you know, the concept of competition driving care. He believes that there can be a fundamentally better way of treating patients if value is at the root of it. So he has defined, and others defined, value as outcomes over the cost of care. And right now, even we in KP who are trying to do this, and others at Michael Dell Medical School, at Geisinger, at places that are really trying to push forth on this, they don't have like a set equation. It's really hard to say, let's just talk about an ACL. So say you do IKDC, the International Knee Documentation Committee, or whatever that stands for, and that's an outcome scale. And then you put that over the cost of the ACL and monitor it over time, and you can't really do that. It's not a simple fraction like 2/4 = 1/2 or 0.5. It's still somewhat complex to do that. But if we start thinking more like that, then maybe we'll get away from this. And I'm not against fee-for-service medicine, but there's a lot of talk about implicit biases today. Implicit biases against race, creed, color, gender. Well, the biggest bias in the world is money, green dollars.
Yep,
right. More than all those other ones.
Right.
And
right.
People who don't say, gosh, I may have done part of that case and coded that because I know I'm going to get paid more money, they're just not, they're lying about the obvious power of the effect of money. And we all want to be paid for the value of our worth. But if somebody says, now the two of you are going to be defined by, is the patient scoring high patient reported outcomes? And did you keep the cost of the total cost of care of the ACL, if you do ACL, or you might be doing triple orthodontics as a foot and ankle surgeon? Are you keeping the cost of care down? And is the patient reporting the pro and your aggregate number of patients reporting the pro really high? So maybe I'll pay you more money than the person down the street who all their pros are in the toilet, they all have infections, and the cost of care was really high because they used a super high metal alloy plate rather than the stainless steel plate, and they totally bumped up the cost of care. So it's really going to fundamentally change how we do things, and I suspect payers will start pushing more and more in that direction. But like I said at the top, it's really hard. It's not like 2/4 = 0.5. Yeah. It's not a simple fraction, even though Michael Porter called it, value equals outcomes over cost. I'll stop talking. Does that prompt any questions?
Yeah, no, definitely. Obviously the question then is, what is the best way to judge your outcomes, right? Because I mean, there's controversies with everything. Patient reported outcomes have their own issues. Complications have their own issues based on, you know, the comorbidities of your patients and the complexity of the cases you're doing. So I know there's not a great answer, otherwise we would have, you know, already found it. But, you know, in your opinion, how do we do this?
No, it's a great question. I think, you know, number one, let's go to the basic old quality. And I call it old because it's what's always been there. Mortality, morbidity, infections, revisions, returns to care for heart wear outs, whatever you want to rank, DVT or venous thromboembolism, just generally, including pulmonary embolus. Those are great, but they're kind of, as you say, we probably first have to risk stratify people, right, to make sure that each of our three populations are being compared in a normative way based on some normative values. The risk of my patient population is lower because they're all young, 24, with no comorbidities. The foot and ankle population population is higher because they're in their 60s on average with a lot of comorbidities, and yours are maybe in the middle. You do that. But back to quality, the basic, the old-fashioned way, I think those are what some people call table stakes. We should expect that we're not going to kill our patients, or that we're going to do everything to reduce readmissions, or that they're not going to get infected. That should be like an basic expectation. Right. You know, it's like me being kind to you on the street. That should just like, I'm kind to you. I don't infect my patients. Obviously nobody's perfect. And I always say this, the surgeon that tells you that they've never had a complication is either one of two things, lying or they've never done an operation. We're all going to have complications, but if we all get to the point where we're minimizing those basic quality measures to kind of a low number, less than 0.2, less than 0.4, that's like an accepted, then we sweep that aside. We say we've optimized all of the surgeons in America. Let's just talk about it in a big way. We've optimized all the surgeons in America. They all know how to do X, Y, and Z, not to get a pyacnes infection after a total shoulder, or not never. You can't never say never, or always in medicine. But to get it below a level that we all deem acceptable, then you just say we've optimized all the surgeons. Then you got to go to the pros. And I agree with you. In my system, we're very slow to uptake pros. We just barely got them into our Epic program. We use Epic and EMR. We call it Health Connect proprietarily, but it's an Epic system. In Kaiser Permanente, and we just got them in. That doesn't mean that the surgeons and nurses and patients are optimized to fill them out. So it can be garbage in, garbage out data, to your point. First of all, you want a validated patient report outcome that's validated externally, not by the writers of it, but by others who have no vested interest in it. And then you have to say, can we get high numbers? In the very beginning of some of the registries, there was a California Joint Replacement Registry, and they were publishing stuff saying Hospital X has this much on patient-reported outcomes after their total joints, and Hospital Y has that. When you go look and dig deeper, there's only like 20 or 30% of the patients are actually filling out the pros. That's garbage in, garbage out data. Like, are we going to say one hospital is better than the other when they're both only responding, the patients are responding at 30 or 40%? So then how do you drive up the pro rates? So validated pros, and then you drive up the rates to at least 80% or something like that, which people say in some studies are starting to say is worth value. And then how do you, so that's the numerator of the value equation. Then how do you do the denominator? The cost. What is the cost? Is it the cost to the patient? What if they, you know, my father was a blue collar guy. He's passed away now, but he was a longshoreman in Southern California. I have a strong union. He had to pay $5 for the surgery, $5 for the for the prescription, and a bunch of zero copays for all his hospital visits. Very powerful dock worker, international longshore warehouseman union, union deal. Powerful union, got great care. So to him, the costs are negligible. What about the cost to the hospital? They're the ones who have to pay for the total joint for the total joint that he might get. And then what about the cost to the employer group? They have to pay the lion's share of the premium per month. So what are costs? Are the costs the cost to which entity? And so I agree with you. It's very complicated. We have to agree on those things, and that's where we need federal help, you know. And you guys are saying no, then it's going to become the post office.
Yeah.
Or, you know, we don't want that, you know, like long lines, slow, kind of disinterested helpers and all that kind of thing, you know. So I agree, this is not easy, but I suspect that in order to not, we love what we do, and I value what the two of you have gone through for your education, and I want you to be paid as high as you can. And all of us should be aware that we can't let healthcare bankrupt America either. So where is that? Where do we balance those two things? Value physicians, pay them. And I don't think the physicians are the biggest aspect to why there's high healthcare costs. You could bang on the drug companies, you could bang on other stuff. So we in Kaiser Permanente, when we you know, this is not going to be, if industry partners listen to this, we tell people, okay, you have this total knee that lasts 30 years, and then now you want us to buy a new total knee the next year with a new metal alloy. There's not a proven entity. Mm-hmm. Your R&D to develop this new total knee is not my problem. You need to provide me 30 years of good outcomes like the old total knee. I would rather pay more for a total knee system that is 20 years of good outcomes to 80 or 90% of the population than the brand new one that's shiny. But even our own docs don't get that. They're like, oh no, we got to get the new thing. The better screw-in anchor that is made of some cool thing that turns into bone or, you know, is a different cool color or whatever it is, you know. I touched on a lot of stuff. Sorry.
No. Awesome. Those are awesome thoughts. A lot of things. You talked about who the cost is going to. There's also societal cost as well, which is everyone. So we think we're all in this together. If I do a surgery on you and it gets you, it's a better surgery for you than for you not to have surgery. But there's a cost associated with the surgery, and it may take you out of work for longer. For example, that's a societal cost as well that has to be taken into account. But also, like you're saying, I think, you mentioned at the end, it's hard to get doctors to buy in as well. And that's, my personal opinion on this is I think value-based healthcare, cost effectiveness, this is kind of the wave of the future. This is the way things are going to be, because the healthcare spending is astronomical. And in my MPH year, they really emphasize that quite a bit. And I think orthopedics, it may be, I don't know if there's resistance among orthopedic surgeons to move in that direction, but I know there's not a whole ton of enthusiasm amongst everyone. Mm-hmm. Why do you think that is? And what is it, just because it's a new concept that we don't understand very well, or is it because we're afraid of what it will do to our reimbursement, or what can be done about it?
I think, it's a variety of things. I think number one, orthopedic surgeons, I don't mean to pat the three of us on the back, but it's a very competitive residency program generally to get into. So it probably takes the best and the brightest, at least in terms of the skill sets that can get you in the residency, scoring high on standardized exams, being attentive and showing up well with others who write you letters of recommendation. Yeah. Those are skill sets that help you to get into orthopedics. And to succeed in orthopedics, you've got to be a self-starter and want to do that extra case. And then people think that you're good, then they write you great letters, so then you go to a good fellowship. And so it's all this stuff that makes you be me-focused. There's different types of leaders. There's the leader that is an independent leader and just says, I can do all this. And so it really formulates a lot of orthopedic surgeons into be independent leaders, which is good. And for some things, like when you're running an OR, you probably want to be independent, kind of a, captain of the ship. So those same people, it's really hard for them to be told, don't do this, don't do that. They don't probably like to be told what to do. This is just Ron Navarro's ideas on this, not really borne out by research. But so that's one piece of it. The other piece, I think, is just back to the conflict of interest that is money and bias. I cannot in my system take, like, it's a very low number, less than $1,000 a year on the Sunshine Act. So, you got a couple dinners, that's you're covered. Yep. And usually I'm at like $13 just because I cave in and let somebody buy me a coffee and a donut, during the year. And that's usually my year. But there's people that are in a lot bigger number, and I don't begrudge them that. But when you are backing a company by being a speaker, by designing implants, etc., you're going to obviously think that there's an unconscious bias that makes you favor that company, and you're going to want to kind of sing the praises of the company. Anybody who says I control that bias, they don't understand subconscious mind. Even if you say consciously I'm controlling this, there's a part of your brain that's behind the curtain, so to speak, that's doing its own thing that you're not even aware of. And so I think that's a piece of it too. And maybe at the end of the day, yes, it is. A lot of people just don't know how to actualize it, to our earlier conversation, how difficult this can be to kind of live this. But if you work in a hospital that still believes that all total joints should be admitted, and the hospital system has a bias because they're going to get paid for 3 days of hospitalization, and then the world is saying, I think I can do all these joints same day. Yeah. And in Southern California, Kaiser Permanente, we're about 80% of our total joints go home same day, and they don't go to a sniff.
Yeah.
And so we already believe that you can do that, but there's big systems that are saying, no, you can't do this. This is going to ruin healthcare. You know, you guys are really young. When I started, we still used to admit rotator cuffs and ACLs. And then we tore the Band-Aid off one day because we didn't want to round on it. You know, yeah. but the total joint surgeons, it seems like it's so much harder to get them to move in this direction. So it's to all these different reasons why people don't want to jump to value-based care. Maybe some of it's just not learning. Some of it's financial in nature. Some of it is just kind of being independent. I don't know. And those were just my ideas. And there's others who would probably argue with me.
Let me bring this up because I think a lot of this value care, one of the controversies with, this kind of value-based reimbursement system is this idea of patient selection and how surgeons will only pick the patients that are the fittest and the ones that don't smoke with well-controlled diabetes. And my personal opinion on this is that I don't really get why it's a controversy if you have the literature to back up the outcomes that, you know, smokers do worse after a total knee and obese patients do worse after almost everything. And smokers definitely do worse after almost everything. So, but you know, there's some people, if I was playing devil's advocate, that would argue that you're denying care to patients that truly need it because of stuff that is either, I guess they would argue that it's out of their control. Where do you stand on this issue?
It's interesting. I in my regional chief role, I sometimes get denials from the state and then have to adjudicate on them. So recently there was a total knee that the person had a BMI of over 40 and the surgeon said, I just don't want to operate on you until BMI gets down because there's a lot of literature that says, you know, same stuff, you know, loosening rates, infection rates are higher in higher BMI groups. Interestingly, in KP's data in our registry, the loosening was not as high, but the infection rate was higher. And that's some people think, you know, people with higher BMI, they don't move around as much, right. So maybe it doesn't loosen as much. But there's a lot of other studies that say both loosening and infection are higher in higher BMI. So then I go back and try and say, you know, should we allow the patient to get it? So to answer your question, I kind of fall out on both sides. Should the conversations between the patient and the surgeon be the informed consent and the idea of shared decision making is just being very explicit and open to the patient and say, you have a greater risk of these things by all this literature, and you put it in your preoperative note or your note so that you medical legally are covered. And then you say, you know, you're taking on these risks and the patient demands surgery and you feel like you can make them better and it's not going to be too hard. Although there's a lot of issues with obesity. Some of the surgeries are just functionally harder to do technically. But if you're a technically good surgeon and you have experience with that and you can do it and you feel like you can make the patient better and they sign the consent, you hope that a lawyer down the line will say, you appropriately consented to them. And then they got infected down the line and you told them their infection rate risk would be higher, then it's not on you and you're not going to lose the case, but you're still going to have to go to court. So there's that interplay too. The other thing is, in my system, for example, there are overt pressures. The state of California might say, well, this was overturned. Can you guys stop telling people? They don't tell me that. This is a hypothetical. Could you guys stop telling people that high BMI is associated with not getting the surgery? And what I tell my surgeons that I work with is, let's have a more nuanced conversation. Say, we're going to think about doing a total knee, and we really need to help you lose weight. So here we're going to sign you up with a dietary consult and weight loss program. Programs and Zoom calls or whatever it is nowadays, and come back in 2 months and I'm not cutting you loose. Let's just see how that's going, and we'll talk about planning the surgery. Then you don't directly link you're not getting your surgery until your BMI is 39. You know, there's ways to do this that the patient goes, "Wow, my surgeon is a partner with me," and I'm not trying to Jedi mind trick the regulators or people within KP who would tell me, why do you guys say that? Or even the patient. I'm just trying to walk along with the patient in a way that shows that I care for them. And maybe that's the way to get around this. And maybe I hedged my bet in the answer and saying, I see why you would want to say no, and I see why you could say yes, and maybe you just have better conversations with your patients.
Right. So you mentioned, you know, fear of legal issue being a driving factor for this. What about, you know, if an insurance company is giving you a bundled payment and, you know, your risk of needing to wash out that knee within 90 days goes higher with a smoker that's obese. And, you know, that's going to be coming out of your pocket instead mm-hmm. of, you know, outside of the legal side. I guess that's one criticism of this, you know, bundled payment program or bundled payment model of reimbursement that, I don't know, I mean, it's not a great answer, like I said before, right? I mean, there's just not it's not a good solution for it. It's just one thing we have to live with, I guess.
No, I think you're right. I mean, it's just risky. What I've said, I value the education. It's 4 years of college, 4 years of med school, 5 years of orthopedics, another year of fellowship. That's a lot of education. And so there has to be value placed in that as long as the surgeon is providing good care to the patients. And it just, you know, I'm a bit of a capitalist. You shouldn't be paid the same as a person who works in a supermarket. It's just a fundamentally different job. I'm not putting them down. It's just a fundamentally different job with a lot more training and a lot more risk on your side, you know. And so there should be a just compensation for that. And how can we get to a point where we can understand, you know, where these risks come into play. And we don't want, so this is the point, we don't want to race to the bottom with bundled care. It's keep squeezing the payment down to the point where we're not satisfying that just payment for years of education and higher risk being taken mm-hmm. by the individual purveyor of healthcare. A surgeon takes on a lot of risks too, you know? It's about the patient. That's why we do it. But the surgeon is also, he's like very close second in the risk. You know, when I give my informed consent, I say risk of bleeding, infection, nerve vessel damage, complication of anesthesia, need for reoperation. Then I say, I say it fast because I say it 200 to 400 times a year. You only hear it one time. So you're an important patient, and I'm taking these risks on 400 times a year. Yeah. I'm right second with you. And there's probably people out there who think that what I just said is really like self-centered, but I think I just am kind of a realist. I'm just trying to say, where's the risk? A lot of risk for the patient, you know. Multiplicative, not exponential, but geometric risk for me.
That's right. I think it's absolutely true. If any complications happen to our patients, they reflect upon ourselves in a way as well, and not only financially, but also reputation-wise, and can have a lot of damage to our careers and even our
emotionally. That second victim stuff. You take a toll. First complications. I think you were at one of those AOA things. I said, just learn to deal with complications, because most residents are on 1 month rotations. They've never followed their patients more than a month. I know you care, and you might see that attending and go, "Hey, how'd he do? How'd she do?" But you don't. It's not your thing.
Yeah.
So when the infection comes back, or the percolating infection, and you're in those first clinics where the acid drips in your stomach and you're not knowing what to say to the patient, man, that's a lot. That's a heavy burden. And we shoulder it all the time, and we learn to become really adept at that too, you know? And so that's what I say in that AOA meeting, and I'll say it again for all the people listening. I think the best way to handle patients in that is to say, I would do for you what I would do for my mom or dad, because it shows you care. You're putting them on the level of your parents. But, you know, back to your question, bundled payments, you know, Rothman, I think, has walked away from them because I think they saw that they had squeezed out all the margin, and then the companies were still saying, now we're going to pay less for the bundle. Now we're going to pay less for the bundle. So it becomes a zero sum game, a negative sum game for the providers of care. You know, it goes to the example when we took a total knee cost of care in the hospital environment is averaged out about $30,000. Mm-hmm. So then people thought, gosh, maybe total knees in surgery centers might be the reemergence of the private practitioners, because private practitioners are shrinking. More people are becoming employed or academic or whatever. And so the individual private practitioner, if he has a part ownership in an ASU, he says, you know what? We'll go to federal government, say it's 20 grand. We're going to save the federal government 10 grand. And I'll be able to pocket more because I'm a part owner in the ASU. Right. Maybe I employ the anesthesiologist that gives some of his action, and I'll get my surgical fee. And so then you end up making more money, but you save the federal government 10 grand. What do the federal government do? They half the time they go, instead of 30 grand that we were paying, maybe we want to pay 8 or 9 grand. So then they just totally squeezed out any margin that anybody was going to get. Yeah. It's like, wow, you're making it to the point where we can't actually live. You know, we all have expenses and bills to pay and loans, you know.
Right.
So sorry if that was also long-winded.
No, that's
tangential.
So one thing with kind of this employed model of practice, maybe switching topics a little bit, but one of the highlights, at least when I was looking for jobs, still looking, one of the strong selling points of being employed is that you have this big hospital system, sometimes a big hospital system, but either way, you have a hospital system that has a brand name behind you, can give you security, you have a salary, your contract is, you know, usually foolproof, like you don't have to worry about doing 10 cases a month or, you know, 500 cases a month if you're in private practice. You have this kind of security blanket over you. And I think the last 6 months during COVID kind of, for a lot of physicians, destroyed you. Kaiser probably handled it better than most because it's one of the biggest groups in the country. But I know for a lot of smaller hospitals, all of a sudden force majeure kind of took in and salaries were cut, incentive bonuses were held, and all of a sudden the security blanket has a lot of holes in it. Did you guys see any of that, or have you heard horror stories about this over the last 6 months, and what do you think?
You know, I just came off a term as president of the California Orthopedic Association, so it's the largest orthopedic association of all the states in terms of volume of orthopedic surgeons, and we spent the last quarter of my term setting up informational webinars on how to get money from the feds and things like that, and how to kind of support surgeons. And much like the Academy, AOS has done, really kind of changed hats and become kind of like a helper to the orthopedic surgeons. So yes, I did hear all these horror stories. And I think it's kind of funny because, you know, If employed physicians, not funny, but I think I wonder about the story being told to the individuals. If you're still taking rates, if you're still taking premiums, and there's less surgeries, most employed physicians are cost centers, not profit centers. So if you're doing less surgery, there's probably less cost.
Right.
So in most systems, if they're honest, they're going to say that they've actually been seeing a huge ballooning of their savings, of the money that, because they haven't had to spend it on expensive utilization costs, because patients were not coming in as much to the emergency rooms and things like that. Everybody's worried about what next year will be. There's horror stories for large HMOs and big populations that maybe next year patients will either become unemployed and then lose their insurance, so that creates a big space of no money being paid in, no premium being paid in or lost, or they'll switch from high paying lines of insurance, commercial, to Medi-Cal or Medicaid in other states it's called, and so then it's you want to do the best for patients and you want to keep that patient on your books, but if it's a low margin payer, it's hard to exist as an organization if you have no margin. You know, you heard that term, no margin, no mission. You can't have a mission for your organization if you're not making enough money to keep the doors open.
Right.
So as much as we want to be charitable and good, we need to make some margins in order to grow the staff and do the remodels and do the upgrades, et cetera. And so I've heard those things. We've weathered it better, and we are worried about what next year is going to bring. So we're trying to get as much done in this fiscal year as possible, because we had large backlogs out of the back end of the shutdowns in California. And the orthopedic backlogs were some of the largest in our system of 4.7 million patients, you know. And so I'm working with each of those 13 medical center chiefs to see what they're doing with their backlogs. They manage their stuff, but I kind of check in with them. How's it going? And then certain medical centers have had new uprisings of COVID, you know, spurts of COVID here or there, and they have to reshut down. So all those things are just still ongoing, and we're just managing issues as they come, you know. But yes, it's been problematic. And yes, this idea of the umbrella of safety in being an employed physician has been stripped away from some. And I would just say, you know, you have to do your due diligence. You have to know what you're getting into and look at the negative. A lot of young people or anybody who's just first starting out, they always just say, wow, this is going to be great. Nothing bad will ever happen. I don't know, just a, you know, Mexican American orthopedic surgeon. I've been facing big negatives my whole life. I always think about the 10 worst things that can happen before the good things. So you're right. I'm always running into low beams, you know. My wife's like, man, you're such a pessimist. I'm just like, no, I just want to be prepared for the worst.
Dr. Khalid's the same way. When I first met him, every room he went to, he would look for an escape in case of a zombie apocalypse.
He's smart.
Always have an exit plan. That's the
So you guys are trained down in Galveston.
That's right.
And are you still there?
I'm not. I'm actually in Central New York now.
Oh wow! Fantastic.
Yeah. And Jay's still there. Jay just went back.
Yeah, I just went back to take a job as assistant professor here.
That's great. I got to visit there once because we looked at. Zimmer had a total connect or something like that. They had a system where they were monitoring your surgical throughput, and you know, they had like electronic whiteboards that were telling which rooms were getting turned over fast. So we flew down to Houston and drove to Galveston. And
oh, cool!
Really beautiful place.
Nice. Yeah. No, it's not California beaches.
It's not North Carolina.
The North Carolina beaches are very pretty as well. But it is nice, and it's a great view from the hospital. Our patient floor is on the 11th floor, so moving around, we just stare outside the big windows that overlook the coast. It's a nice view for sure.
Amazing, and it's had some I know there've been some. Tough times weather-wise, but then they built back up.
Yeah, exactly.
Wasn't there a hurricane of a number of years ago that kind of did some damage? But
every few years, it seems like. But they keep building, expanding. We just opened a large hospital about 3 or 4 years ago. We've expanded our one of our smaller facilities, and we leased another hospital as of a few years ago. So we're trying to aggressively expand as well, despite the hurricanes and the economic situation. So it's been positive. It's been good.
That's great. Well, good for both of you.
Yeah. You know, one thing interesting about academics is that I feel like most academic jobs now are basically hospital employed jobs, right? I mean, you listed a bunch of the enumerations of the benefits of being employed, like the benefits, retirement, health insurance, all that kind of stuff. Not having to, you know, scramble for patients to fill your clinic because you have a huge referral base. I mean, that's basically an academic job at this point, right? Or I mean, I guess an academic job is basically an employee job at this point. I guess it goes to the money again, right? you have to be able to make the money. So,
And are you doing any academics in the middle?
I am not. No, I am not. I am basically employed by a small community hospital at this point. And I've been here for about 3-ish weeks, and I'm starting to see the differences between working in a major hospital and working in a small community hospital. Like today I learned that we do not have vascular surgery at this hospital. And luckily, you know, I wasn't looking for a vascular surgeon. So that's a good thing. I didn't need one, but it's good to know, you know, going forward.
You have less motivation to dissect far away from where you're.
Yeah, I'll stay away from the brachial plexus. I'll leave that to the guys in Syracuse. So, it's been interesting. I'm still on a locums contract here. Mm-hmm. So I still have yet to negotiate a permanent deal, but all of these things, and I guess the nice part about it is that I'm seeing kind of the small hospital just hasn't really had a full-time orthopedist in a while. And you can tell, by the OR. So a lot of the stuff that you take for granted working in a bigger hospital, I'm starting to find out we don't have, and starting to make my list of things I want before, to incorporate in a contract. So actually,
Can I ask you a question? I have a number of friends who have been in these situations, and it's amazing to hear that they still exist, but they really cut their teeth and made great inroads because they say for the first time, you're going to have a PCL done at your hospital ever.
Because
I'm the first one to do it, or your first ladder J, because I'm the first one to do it. So it's great. Absolutely. You need all the resourcing of equipment and personnel to be ready to do these different types of surgeries than they're used to. But you can really become a famous popular surgeon in that area, and things that were always referred out just stay there now, and they come to love you. Is that what you're
I'm seeing that. So it's like I said, the orthopedic surgery here has been pretty sporadic, and mostly it's been total joints, hips and knees, nothing too crazy. So we're starting to do some fracture work and sports work and stuff like that, and I think one of the best experiences about this so far has been actually building an orthopedic, not just a practice, but like a department-ish kind of thing over here, trying to get all the materials we need, trying to talk to people about building up what I want, and kind of molding it to my own based off what I've been trained on. And it's been pretty cool actually so far. So
yeah, I wish you all the luck.
Yeah.
Have you had any obstacles so far? Like
not yet, probably because I still have negotiating power. We'll see once I lose that what kind of obstacles. But no, it's great because the administration here really wants orthopedics, and any hospital should want orthopedics, especially elective orthopedics.
Sure.
To make money for them. So people have been very supportive so far. I mean, I've only been here for 3-ish weeks, but I kind of start putting together the list of things I want, and it's small things. It's like, reusable sterile tourniquets for some of the cases, and certain retractors that you take for granted every now and then. Even things like gown size. Like, I'm tall, but I'm not wide. So I need like an extra long gown, but I don't need a triple XL with gown, otherwise I'm flowing, contaminating everything. So there's just like little things that you take for granted that you have. And then the bigger stuff, just trying to keep some of the hip fractures that they're sending out. I go in to do my first hip fracture, and we were trained on a HANA table pretty much, and all we have is an old fracture table. So I'm figuring out how to do a fracture or a hip fracture on the fracture table, which I know some people are going to listen to this and just be like, wow, you've had it good. But it's things like that it's been an experience, and I think I'm getting better for it, honestly.
Yeah, and you don't have to operate in the dark ages just because others can.
Right.
You should have those modern amenities, and I predict you'll do so well. The community will want you to stay, and in a couple of years, you'll develop like you'll have a joint surgeon, a hand surgeon. You'll just keep, because you can't do it all after a while.
Right.
You just start keeping more, and you'll be able to refine your craft into the lane you most want to be in, sports or whatever.
Right.
You're going to really grow the practice there and really be proud of it in 20 years.
Yeah, no, it's definitely been a good experience, and I had never been to this part of New York before, ever. I grew up in Texas. I've been to the New York City for a few times, but I've never been up here, and it's a little different. It's a little colder, but the scenery here is actually great. So I'm enjoying it a lot. Like the outside, the trees turn different colors in the fall, and I've never seen that before.
So, yeah, I grew up with that. That's
yeah, like I've that. Never seen yellow leaves on trees before, and now it's everywhere. It's been awesome. That reminds me of a question. I heard this question asked once before, and I didn't think the answer that was given was 100% honest. And I want to ask you this because you actually work for KP. And the question that I heard, this was maybe last December, was they were talking to a bunch of fellows and residents, people who are coming out of training, and one of the fellows asked about negotiating contracts, and he said, well, if I'm negotiating with a huge powerhouse like KP or Rothman or and one of these giant things, how much negotiating power do you actually have? What can you negotiate in a contract you know, like, do you actually have any negotiating power with this, or do you just get handed the standard contract, sign on the line here, and that's it?
Yeah, you know, I don't know what kind of answer you got. You can tell me. Tell me after.
I'll tell you after.
You have almost zero negotiating power with Kaiser Permanente. Yep. It's a contract, you know, year by year, and at the end of 3 years, you become a partner, and it becomes a different sort of contract after that. But the pre-partnership contract, it's ironclad, and, once again, the payment is good, but you can't come in and say, I demand $100,000 over what you're offering. They'll just say, the other 10 people right. who want the job are not asking for that later. So, there's not a lot, you know, they sometimes in some hard to fill positions, whether it's a specialty area that is just traditionally hard to fill, or some of our geographic locations, not everything in Southern California is on the beach. So at times some of them have been harder to fill. They might give some sort of like geographic pay or battle pay or whatever.
Right.
And so those are extras that you don't even ask for. You might just show up and they might go, it's really hard to fill in the desert areas or something.
Yep.
So you're going to get some more money, but it's only for a period of time until you become a partner, and then you like it. So you'll be locked in. But the other things, there's no real negotiating power.
Yeah.
And I don't know what the other person told you.
So the other, in full disclosure, the person answering, he was not part of a big hospital system, but his answer was anything in a contract is negotiable.
I was looking at the job a year ago, and people I asked for advice, generally older mentors, they would also tell me the same thing. Like, you know, just if it's not a contract, you're not getting it, just negotiate for everything you want and don't stand down and all that stuff. And so I'm going through the process, and it's just like you said, Dr. Navarro, we like to think we have a lot of negotiating power when we're starting out, and that's what people tell us, but I haven't necessarily found that to be the case at a lot of places. And most of my friends in my year who are also looking for jobs at the same time, they also found that to be the case. I have very few examples of people that I know who actually significantly were able to change their contract. And this applies to academic type contracts and employee contracts and even private contracts. You know, they weren't able to, the exceptions are people who went to very rural locations where there was not an orthopedist in town.
Yep.
They had more power. But if you're going
you
to
have leverage.
A big city, exactly. But for most of us, it doesn't exist in the way we want, I think.
So this is my theory on that, Jay, is a lot of the people you ask have built up negotiating power with the systems that they are in. And thus, when they renew their contracts, they have a little bit of leverage that they can pull to, you know, negotiate for block time or, you know, whatever they want, because otherwise they take their business down the street. If they, you know, they don't have a non-compete, they can take it down the street, and then people will cave. Bottom line is you have to have some sort of leverage with the people you're negotiating. And when you're just starting out, you don't, or even if you're, you know, even if you're established and you go to a big hospital group, the hospital group doesn't need you per se, because, you know, they'll fill it with another orthopedist. So it's all, I mean, it's like I said, it all comes down to leverage and money and, that's my thought. I don't
know. Yeah, I think it's hard to kind of make demands in the beginning. You know, as long as the pay is suitable and there's some vacation built in and there's some reasonableness about call, and those are the major things. And you see those in place and you want to be in that location, you're just like, heck, I'm going to go for this. And, you know, that you guys asked me at the beginning, that first job I had, it certainly paid me well for the time that I got out, but it was just the other things that I didn't even know about to negotiate too. Half the time we don't even know what we don't know to negotiate, you know?
Yep.
Exactly.
So, all right. Well, it's been an hour, Dr. Navarro. So,
I'm sorry if I,
No, this was great. I don't even think we touched on everything that we were going to. So, I mean, that just means we have to bring you back and do it again. So,
well, no, it's been really a pleasure, and thank you both for your time, and it's a pleasure to meet you virtually in this environment. And I'm sure when the world comes back to normal, we'll see you at an academy meeting and we'll
have for sure.
Or something.
Absolutely. Well. Yeah. Well, it was a pleasure. Thanks for coming on. Thanks for giving us your insight. And like I said, we'll have to do it again sometime. So.
No, my pleasure. Thanks.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Navarro. Thanks, sir.
All right. Take care.
And that'll do it for this week. Thank you to Dr. Navarro for giving us some of his time. Hope you guys enjoyed that perspective. It's not one you hear every day, and hope it was informative for you guys. If you guys like what you're listening to, leave us 5 stars on your favorite podcasting platform. If you want to hear the rest of our episodes, you can do so at our website, orthotalkpod.com, or you can get in touch with us on Twitter at orthotalkpod or Gmail, theorthopodcast.com. You can find Dr. Navarro at his Twitter handle, at BoneDoc95. And hope you guys are enjoying what you're doing, and thank you for the opportunity.